special meeting time?
10 o'clock.
Thank you very much. I take pride in the fact that I was the first Kol Yom Rishon presenter after Rabbi Brand Shlita and the members of the Kol came to town. For me, this is particularly gratifying. I've been here two or three times. This is the first time that my dear Mechutanim, the Friedmans, Mike and Rina, are here. So it's a pleasure to greet them, in addition to the Mor Hadass, Rabbi Engel, Shalita, and the other notable guests, all of you. Marriage is an important part of life. As a matter of fact, full disclosure, I'm here to perform a marriage, to perform a wedding with a member of this very community, Adam Kirshner, who served as my shiur assistant for the last 2 years, having been in my shiur even before that, very loyal and a wonderful Talmud from a wonderful family, MAGA, a wonderful family from Chicago. And yes, they have signed the prenup. Right up front, they have, in my own office. Because I request that every chasen kal that I'm privileged to marry sign it. And I view it as an insurance policy. Insurance policy, we don't want to have any problems in our lives. We don't want to even think about these things. Many of us have life insurance. We don't want to think about that. But we have it, because it's the responsible thing to do. Let's call this marriage insurance. I'd like to give my own personal saga as it pertains to my involvement in this project. Believe it or not, this past Shabbos, which was, Thanksgiving weekend, and Erev Rosh Chodesh Kislev, today being Rosh Chodesh, I celebrated the 38th anniversary of my coming to Riverdale of Proba. It was exactly the same kind of a Thanksgiving weekend on a Erev Rosh Chodesh Kislev. And shortly thereafter, I moved into my community to serve as the Rav and the Young Israel of Riverdale. And already at that time, in New York City, there had been a number of these difficult aguna cases. And it always bothered me that the rabbi seemed to be so impotent and just standing by and just empathize, which is itself important, but not being able to do anything about these cases. And I resolved that if it ever comes to my hands, im yavo liyodi, if something comes to my shul, I'm not going to just stand idly by. I'm going to do something active, proactive, to try to help out a woman in distress. Thank God I had a charmed life for quite a few years. I would say about 15 years I had no problems. There were a couple of divorces. They were taken care of other ways. There was no real aguna issue as such. Never came to me. A woman never came to me to complain, I want to get, and she's not giving it to me. But, you know, like all good things, my time ran out. And in 1989, I had the first case came to me. The woman, I had actually been counseling the couple, a very fine couple, it was fine and dandy, but she had asked for a get, and he refused to give it, and he said if she doesn't do X, Y, or Z, she's going to be an aguna. When I heard that word, the A word, this is like the red flag in front of the bull. Here's what I committed to myself over 15 years before. I'm not going to let this happen, and here it's happening right in front of me. He said the word. This was a big problem. I said, you're required to give your wife a get and to give it now. No. Okay. I said, you know, you're really not welcome here because I declare you have to give a get. So he exercised the inalienable right of every Jewish balabas. To go to a different shul, a different rabbi. No problem. But I live in Riverdale, which is a nice community, and we are fortunate that there is a certain measure of working together amongst the rabbonim. And this person was an honest person. He told the whole story to Rabbi Rosenblatt, Shalita, the Riverdale Jewish Center. He heard everything from his vantage point only. He didn't even hear the other side. He said to him, my dear friend, give a get, and you have to give it now. Now he's really in deep trouble. In desperation, there's one other shul, a large shul in our community called the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale. Rabbi Avi Weiss went to him, told him his whole story. Only his side, and the rabbi tells him, you have to give the get, you have to give it now. Nope, he refuses. And the case starts wending through the courts, and after a while we think this is ridiculous. It's not right that the person should have access to our shuls. So I called him up with the agreement of my two colleagues and said, my dear friend, you're not invited to any of the shuls until you give your wife a get. If you come in, we're going to stop the services. Ad kedei kach. We were scared he's going to come in, but he didn't. It was a one little private shul for retirees down the block, so we said, we don't, he has to daven. So he davened there. Obviously, he was considered to be out of the community for this time. After a few months, my balabatim, who was sympathetic to him, as I was, come to me, Rabbi, you take such a harsh stand, what are you doing? I said, I give you three choices, my dear balabatim. I think it's the only meeting I ever had we don't have meetings by us. I met with the officers and the gaboyim. I don't think it's happened before or since, but that was a very serious issue. It was already, I think, probably it could be at the beginning of 1990 by now. So I give you three choices. One, you convince him to give a get. That's great. Number two, you don't like the way I'm handling it. No problem. I'll be the rav. You'll hire an Av Bezdin. You'll hire somebody else, someone who I'll approve, and let him handle it. Three, I'm your Rav Bezdin. Option four is not an option. What's that? Anarchy. That's not an option in the shul. We can't allow it. And at the end of the day, option one and two were not carried out, so I consider myself appointed as the Rav Bezdin. And we went on and on and on. This goes on for 6 months, from right after Sukkot of 89 till after Pesach of 1990. Before Pesach, I told my Talmidim, we happened to have been learning Gittin that year in the yeshiva. Just no coincidences. We learned Gittin. And I told the boys, after Pesach, I can't handle this anymore. We have to put our minds to this. We have to find a way that this shouldn't happen again. It's been going on for 6 months. Kadosh Baruch Hu helped. The case came to an end in the secular court. It was a very smart judge. She was a female Jewish judge. And she knew how to handle the situation. She said, listen, I'm dividing your assets 50-50, but this lady wants a get. If you give her a get within 10 days, I give you 55%, tells the man. That's a very crucial distinction. She didn't penalize him for not giving a get. She rewarded him for giving a get. Otherwise, it could have been a problem of an illicit get, a get ma'usa. The get was given. You know the exact date. Today is Rosh Chodesh. It was given on Rosh Chodesh. It was the day of the Siyum of Daf Yomi. Those who know that, it was the 9th. It was a Rosh Chodesh year of 1990, right after Pesach. The next Shabbos, a day or two later, he walks into shul. I told the gabbai, you must give this man shlishi. Shlishi. That's the most honorific aliyah you can get if you're not a Kohen or a Levi. Shlishi. The gabbai says to me, I don't understand you, Rabbi. For 6 months, he was persona non grata, and now you give him shlishi? I said, absolutely. I had nothing against him, I never did. He wasn't giving his wife a get against the ruling of the Rabbanim, so he couldn't let him in. He gave the get, he deserves shlishi. Shlishi, nothing else. The gabbai is a good gabbai, gives him shlishi. After the next aliyah, go over and shake his hand in front of the whole shul. He wasn't so excited, but okay. I wanted to show that from my perspective, no problem. And thank God, still had a happy ending. He remarried, she remarried, and life goes on. This could go on for years and years. We all know cases, it's terrible. So Baruch Hashem, it was resolved in this fashion. It was one other case, which was a little bit rough and tough, but the guy already knew my position, so he gave the get right away also. And thank God. B'liyai and Hara. Should be no more cases. But after Pesach, back in the yeshiva, this is even before the get was given, right after, we start learning the sugya at the end of Masechta Gittin, very famous sugya of get me'usa, towards the last daf. What can we do to help the situation? So we learn the classical sources. The classical sources tell us that we cannot do something which is going to be forcing the husband to give a get against his wishes. There's a get ma'usa shalokedin. A forced get against the wish of the husband is invalid. So you're making bigger problems. What may we not do? You may not hit him. You may not incarcerate him. You may not excommunicate him. You may not take away his money, which he's entitled to. All these things that do not. No, no, no. If you do it, it casts a very significant question about the validity of the get. So you can't do any of these things. That's why we're stuck. Now some of you may say, but you learned in the yeshiva, kofen oso ad sheyomar rotani. You hit him until he says, I want. That is true. That's only in very limited cases. Very, very limited. You almost never have such a situation. the average case, we certainly don't have it, and therefore, it's a tool in our arsenal in limited cases, but doesn't work in the average case. So that's out. So now we're stuck. So the only way that we can create an incentive for such an individual to create, to give his wife a get, is only one way. That's a financial incentive. We heard what the judge did, 100% kosher, gave an incentive to give the get right away, he did it. We have to create our own incentive. But you have to be a little bit careful in how we formulate the incentive. It should not be construed in any way as a penalty, which causes a problem, which we shall see, but rather should be something which is not a penalty in its nature. So I'm going to review for you some of the more recent situations which were brought up by various rabbanim suggestions. One of them was something which is the following. The ksuba. What could be better? The ksuba. The ksuba calls for a husband. And we're going to read the whole view at the wedding today. Vana ezon vafarnes. I will support you. I will feed you. That's it. He has an incentive. As long as they're married, they're married. He has an obligation, as we say in the ksuba. Muzonaichi, ksusaichi, vesipukaichi. All this stuff, shera ksusa, you have to do as long as you are married. So we'll simply tell him, listen, mister, you have to support your wife as long as you're married, and this will be given an incentive to end the marriage once it's functionally dead anyway, they're no longer together anyway. Why must he pay her all the time money? This doesn't make any sense. Why should he do it? So he'll give his wife a get. Just say, translate the ksuba, and that should solve all the world's problems. Ah, things should only be so easy. Number one, we have no quantity. He'll support his wife. He'll say, I'll give her a dollar. How much does she need to live already? It's not quantified. That's number one. More significantly, what is the halacha if a couple breaks up? Does the man continue to have an obligation to support his wife if they're no longer living together? This is not a simple matter. Indeed, in the Shulchan Aruch and Evan Ezer, it tells us clearly what the din is. It all depends whose fault the breakup is. Simple. If it's his fault, he continues to be obligated. If it's her fault, the obligation terminates. What's the problem? How are we going to determine whose fault it is? If you know the way the system works there in various but they did, she can literally turn white before a bezdin convenes and to get a fair day in court. Not so simple. So in theory, the ksuba should be enough. You have to translate it, quantify it, notarize it, all these things, very good. But in point of fact, it's going to fall short because he will say, we're not living together, and since we're not living together anymore, I'm exempt because it's her fault. And she has to go disprove it. The burden of proof is on her. We have a famous rule. Hamotzi mechavero olavaraya. She wants the money, so therefore she has to bring the proof. If she can't bring the proof, she's not entitled to the money. Not entitled to the money, there's no incentive to give a get, and she sits there. That's the problem with this particular suggestion. So there were some additional considerations, even within the ksuba. You may be aware of the fact, although the ksuba itself is a unilateral document, that he gives things to her, there are certain things she gives him in return. As a matter of fact, we learned in Gemara Ksubas, it's a quid pro quo. He gives her support, she gives him her earnings. In today's world, those earnings very likely can be much greater, we hope, right? For the ladies should make an equal pay for equal work. They should be getting so much money from their earnings that it's more than he's going to have to pay her. So he'll say, honey, I'm happy to give you X dollars a day that we made up. You give me your paycheck. So what does that do? Does that accomplish a zero? It is true that a woman has the option to say to her husband, honey, Aini nizonis vi aini osa. Don't feed me, and I keep my own earnings. But then we're back to square one. So then he's still not going to give it again. So this is a problem with the regular obligation of ksuba. So one of the rabbis had a following suggestion. Any attorneys in the room? Anyone who's not an attorney in the room? Okay. I quote, in the event of any breach of this contract, he promises to give her a get, the injured party shall be entitled to injunctive or mandatory relief, directing specific performance of the obligations included herein. That's legalese. If he doesn't give the get as he promised to do, then there's injunctive or mandatory relief. What does that mean in plain mamaloshen? What's the end of the end of the end of the day? Where does he end up? Contempt of court. And where does he end up? One more time? That's right, jail. That's a big problem. Because as we said before, if you incarcerate him and he gives the get under to avoid the incarceration, that's a serious problem, casting a cloud of get me'usa shalokadin. Very serious problem. So, another one, suggestion went as follows. Okay? If you prevent her ability to remarry, it should constitute substantial damage. They're incapable of determination. So the arbitrator shall be authorized to impose in their decree liquidated damages, another legal term, in an amount of $250 a day. Whee! That's a lot of money, especially this goes back to in the 80s when this was suggested. A lot. That's a lot of money. Even today it's a lot of money. So much so, so much more so even then. So now, what's wrong with this? What's wrong with it is, what do you mean damages? What do you mean, why is he obligated? He's not really obligated in this. He's accepting it upon himself. Such a huge sum cannot be considered or construed as a support obligation. It's too much money. So it has to be construed as an effect as a penalty clause. Now it's true, it's a self-imposed penalty clause. The Ramah says, Ibn Ezer, in the case of a self-imposed penalty clause, the get should not be given. But if it's given, after the fact, the get is a kosher get. But who wants to get involved in such kind of circumstances where there's a get? Some say the Ramah is wrong. Some say the Ramah didn't really mean it. You're going to run into a big problem. So therefore, the only way to create something which is going to actually work is to have a support agreement. Support agreement. Shortly after I entered into the research way back in 1990, I discovered that in a Torah journal which had been printed 2 years before, there was a suggestion by a great Godel and Tzaddik, Rabbi Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, son-in-law of the famous of Shlomo Zalman Orbach, along these kinds of lines. He said, you make an obligation, you give $50 a day, da-da-da-da-da-da, and it worked. Somebody's going to work. I said, oh, here we have some kind of thing which is going to work. Let me jump on the case. So, I was given an introduction on the phone to this great Godel. When I called him, and he knows Kol HaTorah, and I know almost nothing, he treats me like, oh, with such honor and such respect. Please write me your questions. I wrote him, he wrote me back. This is incredible. Such an Adam Godel. And we're going along, and I said, you know, maybe this is really going to work. But I realized after a while, I have to meet him face to face, because otherwise it's just not going to happen. So, got on the plane. This is already the next January. We have this between these semesters. It was January of 1991. Who remembers what happened in Eretz Yisrael, January 1991? Who remembers? The Gulf War. Now, so I walked in. My two oldest boys were in Karen Biavon at the time, and I walked into the yeshiva there to visit them. Oh, Rebbe, it's going to be a war. How'd they know? Because I was there for the 67 war. If I'm in the country, it's going to be a war. But it's interesting, the history of this prenup is literally in the shadow of the war. So I came, remember, he said, come to my house. I came to his house. He accepted me with such great honor and warmth, and his wife, the daughter of Salman, accepted me with such great warmth. But by the way, that warmth continues until this very day. Literally, I got a call from his son-in-law, Rabbi Zalman Nechemya's son-in-law, last week. My last January trip, I was trying to get him. I couldn't find him because he was marrying off a grandchild, and I had him come to the Shever Brachos in the house, and I was asked to speak at the Shever Brachos in his house where all his children were around. It's such the connection. It came from a bad thing, in effect, helping out a tough, but it's a wonderful connection. Oh, as we said, over 20 years. So he says to me, you know what, I think it's good, but you can't go to the bank with me. You have to get someone else. I said, Rebbe, who else should I go to? He said, you know, you're going to go to the top, all, you know, the people who were already then, the older generation, the people who were in the 80s. It's not going to work. He's a smart man. It'll be politics. Go to my colleague, who's one of the, I think it's probably the greatest dayan in the country. Go to Reb Chaim Tzimbalist. And whoever heard of that name, probably never heard of him. He's he was considered the premier dayan, so much so that there was a fight in a major yeshiva in Bnei Brak, terrible fight, still going on, and they wanted to have a din Torah, but they came to Rav Yashiv, who should be the Shalosh, the main judge. And of all the judges in the entire country, he chose Rav Tzimbel List. And when they attacked him with the Paskvil, and they came to his assistant, said, no, he's the best Dayan, etc. He's a great Talmud Chacham. The two of them knew each other from the Chevron Yeshiva. They were like the big stars of Chevron way back when. So I come to him in Tel Aviv. He lives in Tel Aviv. He's a Dayan and Den in Tel Aviv. He looks at this and says this, and I don't like it. This seems to be not exactly right. I think you should do it this way. And he twists it around a little bit. His way. I listen very, he's very, very wonderful. His wife is an American, so talk, you know. Fine. I'm going home, getting on the bus. I say to myself, it's over. I traveled all the way to Eretz Yisrael. I've been working on this now for the better part of a year. And it's over. Why is it over? Because one rabbi says do it this way, and one rabbi says do it that way. It's going to end up neither way. That's what I figured. I'm in trouble. I didn't realize how great the people were. I come back to Abzalam Nehemiah. If Chaim says this way, we'll do it his way. Can you imagine that? He printed this already 2.5 years ago. He's corresponded with me for the better part of a year. And in 1 second, okay, do it his way. And therefore, he said, we'll do it Abchaim Tzimbalist's way, which is exactly what we have to this day. And it turns out that this idea has a precedent going back hundreds of years. People ask, it's a new thing. It's not really a new thing. It's fundamentally, it's the same thing as it goes back to the 17th century and maybe even to the 12th century. How is that possible? What was this? Maybe. If you look in a sefer called the Nachlas Shiva, that's the book on Shtar. It's the book, the classical book in Simon Tess. There's something called Tanoim Acharonim, which means the Tanoim which I saw just before the wedding. And there has the following phrase. And by the way, did anyone here get married with Tanoim? Raise your hand if you got married with Tanoim. You did? Did you have the classical Tanoim or the new ones? The new ones. We call them Moshe's Tanoim. He took everything out. Did anyone get married with a long piece of paper with a Tanoim? No. Okay. In that classical Tanoim, it has the following sentence. You can count the words. Umachmas idur uktat yomad kitakonas shum. 6 words, the whole thing. In case it's an idur, what does idur mean? What does it mean ne'edar? Missing. That's a nice way to say death. You know, when a person dies, he's missing. For a long time, he's absent. Right? Uktat, what's a ktat? What's a ktat? Ktata, what's a fight? Fight, argument. Yomad kitakonas shum, what's takonas shum? Who knows what shum stands for? Yes? Three cities, Speyer, Vermeise, Magenta, so the three great German cities, where apparently they had this concept, which is found in the Nachlas Shiva, in case a couple separates, the man agrees to give X number of zuhuvim right away, and every month another X, 10 zuhuvim, until the Bezdin can put the couple together. And what if they can't put them together? That's an until, which is ultimately a little bit wishful thinking. My interpretation of this Nachlas Shiva is that doesn't mean what it really says. What it really means is the guy doesn't want to give his wife a get. So we'll say, well, until we can put them together, he should give 10 gold coins a month. But that really means if they'll never get together, he'll give her a get. It's not that she shouldn't starve to death in the interim, but so it should be an incentive to give her a get. In this, I can't be sure that I'm right. It's hard to go read the minds of the individuals who formulated this. Come back to it. So therefore, we can do the same thing ourselves. If the couple is no longer living together, then he has to give her 10 zuhuvim. I tried my best to find out what 10 zuhuvim was in Polish coins in the 17th century. If anybody has an expert, I spoke with some experts, if you have greater experts, please let me know, and we'll figure out what was that. Was that a penalty, in effect, or a very large support agreement? Or was it just an average support agreement? Since I don't know, I believe we have no right to impose anything more than an average support agreement in our day. Fine. So therefore, what happens? What happens is as follows. the din of the Shulchan Aruch really takes effect. If the couple separates, then he has a potential obligation to support her, whatever the typical support is in that particular time and place. Yes, he can get out of it by saying it's her fault. This closes that window. This closes that window. We don't care whose fault it is that the couple marriage is breaking up. Doesn't matter. You right now have an obligation to give this amount per day, and that's all. Finished. The only way out is either to give her a get, you're no longer married, or, because fair is fair, come to the Beis Din. You come to the Beis Din, make your case in front of the Beis Din, you explain to the Beis Din why the marriage should stay, or why you should be relieved from this obligation, whatever you explain to them. They'll hear you out, and then they'll give a decision, and pending their decision, you will either bring the marriage together, you'll give a get, you'll do neither, whatever the Beis Din says, but you listen carefully. If you don't do what the Beis Din says, it's going to cost you per day. This is the fundamental principle of Nachlas Shivas Simetes, which is the way our symbolist wanted to do it. As he put it to me then, it makes sense. This is a logical obligation. We're not doing anything really new. It's the same old obligation. But if a couple is living together and they're happy in their marriage, we don't have his account and her account and he's giving the exorcist. It's all in one pot, the way it should be, because we don't make these calculations. But if they're no longer together, we have to make these calculations. This is the essence of this prenuptial agreement. And it went through a number of different, what we'll call Gilgulim, different phases since it was initiated way back then in 1990 and 1991. For a minute. So after I went back to Ozam Nechemeh, he said, okay, do it his way. So I had to go back and forth. I remember this is, I had to go back to Rav Tzimbel List to make sure that the way I did it was what he wanted. And I went to him, I remember distinctly when I went to him, that was the day that Operation Torah Shield arrived. Those are another war you sent to a couple hundred guys. Right, a few days before this, the scuds were falling. I went to the airport to meet them, as many others did. From there, I went straight to Tel Aviv to a symbolist. By the time I got back to Yerushalayim, the streets were already deserted. There's already, for those who know the dates, this is a Tuesday night, right before the war broke out. Wednesday was, I think it was that January 15th, that the old George Bush gave us his deadline to... P.S., I had to go back to Ozam Nechemeh. I was leaving. I had a flight that Thursday night to go back to New York. He said, I'm busy today. I'm saying shurim all over the country. Come with me to Shalavim. He gives a shiur that night. So I get into the car to Shalavim. This is Wednesday. And we're going, and he's looking it over. And he wrote this new on the back of an envelope that I had with me that someone had given me, one of my friends. He writes the whole thing out. Good. We come back. It's late at night. The streets are totally empty now. I go to sleep. And the next day, I'm going to get up and, you know, okay, have a day to do what I want to do and go on the plane at 1 a.m. In the middle of the night, my in-laws wake up, go, a war broke out, this is happening, now there's a fight and everything. So what? They said, you know what? You're not going to leave the house. Can't leave the house. My father didn't go to Minyan, which is for him unbelievable. Didn't go to Minyan. I couldn't go either. I'm going to be braver than him. So I was davening myself. I get a call from El Al. The plane is leaving instead of 1 a.m., it's leaving at 5 p.m. I said, but you said I can't leave the house. For this, you can leave the house. So sure enough, one of my Israeli friends takes me to the airport. They're not worried about that. Can you take my mail? Yeah, I'll drive it to the airport too. We get there, get on the plane, no problem. I land in New York, and I said, what's going on over here? While I was in the air, the scuds started. So I just missed the scuds. That's just a side personal point. Anyway, so the... I go, now I have to go sell this to the lawyers. Because I was working with lawyers. If it's not enforceable in American law, the whole thing is pointless. It took me almost an entire year to get this thing done with my lawyers and how to rephrase it. Now I go back. I went back, nothing wrong. I went back a second time to Eretz Yisrael, a year later. This time I wanted to finish it up, which I did. Back and forth a little bit. Typed it up. Went to Rav Zalman Nechemi, he signed it. Went to Rav Tzimbel List, he signed it. Then I needed someone for the Sephardic community, I went to Rabbi Vadja, he signed it, came back to the United States, and Rabbi Libus Zichron Levracha was the head of the Igud Rabbanim Bezdin in New York, signed it, and Rabbi Schwartz Shalita also signed it. So I had five signatures, I'm ready to go. That's why I said, as far as I'm concerned, you can do it right now. This goes back, the date was Rosh Chodesh Shvat Tovshin Nun Beis. That was 20 years ago. So we started doing it, and then we started giving it out, different forms. you have in front of you, since you have it in front of you, let's take a look and see what it says, what this document says. We're not going to read every single word, we don't have enough time for every single word, but we have time to analyze some of it. The top is just the names and the addresses, and it's fundamentally, as you see what it's called on top, binding arbitration agreement. I want to stop for a second to give cover to Rabbi Schwartz. Please give the proper cover. It's a new cover, Latire. So it's called a binding arbitration agreement, partly for legal reasons. It's more enforceable in at least in New York State, not sure here in Illinois, than what they call a prenuptial agreement. There are certain conditions they impose upon prenuptials, they don't impose on arbitration agreements. That's why it's given that title. And the first point is that if there's a problem between the parties, they refer it to the Beis Din of America, headed by Rabbi Schwartz Shalita. The Beis Din of America is an honest Beis Din, which tries to reach reasonable conclusions based upon the facts placed in front of it. And that's no mean feat. Unfortunately, there are too many people who want to take their cases to secular court, which is prohibited, according to Torah law, and also does not yield a good result, for those who know. And there are those who want to take it to other Batei Din, but there are all kinds of issues we're not going into right now. So the mere fact that it's been going to the Beis Din of America is a wonderful thing. People tell me, you're signing this before you're married? This can jeopardize the marriage. To which I respond, this can save the marriage. Because if the marriage is tottering, and people are jockeying for position, oh, I want to go here, I want to go there, because after all, I'll be better off in this bed, I'll be better off in court. That itself kills the marriage, the jockeying for position. But if you know in advance where it's going to go, if there's a problem, you're going to go to the Beis Din of America. You know, no matter what, you can try to reconcile the marriage. You can try to go to counseling and do a better job when this is already in place, which you signed when you were in love, not when you were in hate. It's signed before they're married. Okay? So it's a very good thing in and of itself. If only just to get them into a proper Beis Din, this is wonderful. Again, for halachic reasons, there shouldn't be in violation of proper Beis Din procedure. And it helps save the marriage. Rav Moshe Feinstein has the children to this effect, that they can write before they get married. If there's a problem, they'll go to a particular Beis Din. And Rabbi Per Shalita from Yeshiva Farakway, who was the one who received that tshuva, does it. Before you get married, you can order this Beis Din. And why does he do it? Because he's seen the difficult problems that exist in the absence of such a prenuptial agreement. As we mentioned before, we go a little bit further than that, and we give particular jurisdiction to the Beis Din of America to get Ksuba, Tanoim, and this document itself. We also prefer giving additional jurisdiction to the Beis Din to discuss matters of finance and even issues of child custody and visitation. Truth be told, child custody and visitation can be overturned by any state in the union of their court. They consider themselves in charge of the children. But that's in theory. In practice, if you do a good job and you have a psychologist as good or as bad as their psychologist, they're not going to bother you. They have enough on their plate. And all of our decisions have stood. Within the financial piece, there are three options for A1, B, 2, and 3. Some individuals, for whatever reason, want to have the financial matters decided by laws other than the straight law of the Torah. And it's according to our poskim, Rav Zalman Nechema printed about this, it's permissible to do so if they make up in advance and they're specific, referring to a specific law of the present time. And we have over here, we don't even have laws of particular states. Rather, we have things which are called equitable distribution or community property, respectively. For those who know, New York is equitable distribution, California is community property. That means split 50-50. Community means 50-50. No, four. That's a 50-50. I already told you before, in New York, they have equitable distribution. It could be 55-45, whatever the judge decides. If people want that, it's an option, because this way more people can sign it than would otherwise. Although I always recommend just to leave it the way it is in terms of the halacha, which is the first option. Here comes after the boilerplate, which we don't have time to read right now, the key critical italicized paragraph in section number 7 on page 2. I hereby now may achshav obligate myself to support my wife to be from the date of the domestic residence together shall cease for whatever reason at the rate of $150 per day. This has gone up. It started at 50, as I told you, went up to 100. Now it's 150. Do a little arithmetic. That's $50,000+ to live. Is that too little or too much? Let's think, that's, you know, living expenses. I'm not sure what they are in Chicago. I know what they are in New York. It means you have to rent an apartment, right? Probably have to have a car, I'm guessing. Most people have to have a car. You have to have various insurances, health insurance, etc. You have to eat. You have to have clothes. Whoever's looked at the clothing bill for Aisha's Chayal knows that that could be significant. And you put everything together, and it comes out to a certain amount of money per day, week, month, year, whatever you want to come to. This is an approximation of how much it costs. Of course, it could become much greater with inflation 20 years from now, so there's an index over here. And this is given in lieu of my Jewish law obligation of support. In other words, instead of giving her the money, as you did when you were together, you just took care of her, as you're supposed to do by the ksuba, you're giving her a fixed sum. Also, you waive your halachic rights to the earnings. This waiver is in effect deemed to have been repeated at the time of the wedding, so it should be at the proper time between the erusin and the nisuin. And the truth to tell, even in the absence of such a waiver, it's possible here the woman can say, eini nizonis v'eini osa. But this particular obligation is not the straightforward obligation of nizonis, which is in the ksuba. It's an independent obligation. Okay, this is what it's done. But it's not fair to the husband. What happens? She's just going to live an easy life and collect the money until 120. Look at the next paragraph. However, this support obligation shall terminate if wife-to-be refuses to appear upon due notice before the Bezdin of America, or in the event that the wife-to-be fails to abide by the decision or recommendation of the Bezdin of America. So therefore, if she doesn't do what the Bezdin says, then the obligation terminates. That's all. Ends. So therefore, the husband's in a rush to get the Bezdin, right? The guy was running away from the Bezdin all the years. Now he's in a rush because he wants to end this agreement. He doesn't want to pay the money. Okay. Furthermore, wife-to-be waives her right to collect any portion of support obligation attributable to the period preceding her reasonable attempt to provide written notification to be that she intends to collect the above sum. You have to have a notarized signature. Where does this come from? Someone wrote in the New York newspapers this past week that this has never been tested in court. Never been tested in court. Not true. It's been tested in court. I'll tell you the case that happened. This is what happened. Some man was acting in good faith, but it took a long time while they're negotiating, while they're arguing, till they gave the get. So he gave a get. It took 3 years till he gave a get, because that's how things were schlepping. Not that he threatened to ever make an agun. It just took that long. So he gives the get, everything's fine and dandy. She slaps him with a bill afterwards, $100,000. $100 a day for 3 years. So I mean, that's what she said. So it came to our Bezdin, and the Bezdin made a pshara. They said that, look, from the moment that he actually went to Bezdin and said, I'm ready to give the get this moment, this very minute, he's already exempt. So instead of $100,000, it was $10,000. They both appealed the decision. All appeals go to Rabbi Schwartz, Shalita. He said, I don't want to give her a penny, acting in good faith. She says, I want $100,000. That's a technical reading of the document. Rabbi Schwartz passed the hot potato to me. So I was the appellate judge in the case, and I wrote an appellate decision. And the appellate decision was challenged in secular court in Maryland. Your state. Maryland. And the judge upheld my decision, but in spades. So it's a great decision. It makes perfect sense. The document is good. Everything's fine. In it. So I'm proud of that. It's a good thing. Baruch Hashem. So this has an ability to achieve this desired result. Now, I'd like to discuss in the brief time left over, are there any objections or any further clarifications? There, Rabbi Yosef Shalita, in that same article I referred to back in 1988, had a hesitation about any of these kinds of prenups on the grounds that the person who signs it doesn't know what he's signing. Doesn't know what he's signing. There are two responses. One is that he does know what he's signing. The proof is people fight about it. So I know for myself, I don't want to sign. I don't agree with this. It's in English. It's not an Aramaic. And number two, I'm not sure why it matters. It says in Shulchan Aruch, if you sign something, you sign anything, you sign your lease, whatever you sign, it's binding because you sign it. He also raised the specter, not himself in his printed article, but some of his followers raised the specter of asmachta. Asmachta is a contingency obligation, although maybe only in a case of an exaggerated obligation. This is not exaggerated. It also has certain protections. It's called me'achshav. What's called kinyan me'achshav, and the bezin choshev. We're looking at the small print in the italicized paragraph, which should overcome it. I concede that according to the Rambam, it would not overcome it. That's what I concede, and Rav Yosef has it in one of his tshuvas. Nonetheless, we don't follow the Rambam. We follow the Shulchan Aruch, we follow the Ramah. And even according to Rav Yosef himself, he has a different volume of his tshuvas, in which he claims that he has the following question. It always bothered me, this question. My Tamidim asked me. Every ksuba contains a contingency obligation. Tosefes ksuba. In case it's a death or divorce, I'll give you X thousand, some they write $1 million, all kinds of things are written. So why isn't that a case of asmachta? So we do say a kinyan, and maybe it's considered to be automatically a bezin choshev. As a matter of fact, Rabbi Yosher has a different answer. He says, based on the Gemara Masech the Kiddushin, that if the two mechotonim get together and they make certain commitments to each other, hein advarim aniknim b'amira, no formal acquisition means is required. Just the word itself. So Yosef says, for that reason, there's never going to be a problem of an asmachta in the case of a ksuba, because it's just before the wedding. So to a prenup, which is just before the wedding, so would appear based on that logic. Truth is that I tried to get some additional haskamas from some of my friends, rabbinical friends in Brooklyn, who have a lot of clout. One of them I went to was the famous Rav Feivel Cohen, author of Bari HaShulchan, but more important, author of Midor L'Dor, which is a book he has about Shtar Chatzei Zochar. In that Shtar Chatzei Zochar, not for now, but for a different time, there is exactly this, an exaggerated contingency obligation, which is protected by the same exact defense of Kinyan Me'achshav Bebezin Choshev. I knew he had to be on my side, which he was. And in a case later on, when his own son-in-law had to perform a wedding with a prenup, and he hesitated, and I told him all the various objections, he said, it's fine, you can do it. So certainly these people, Rabbi David Cohen, all said you can do it. They didn't do it. They're living in a different world and unfortunately suffering for it. Recently, just last year, 2 years ago, the famous Rav Usher Weiss Shalita, who was an unknown 20-something years ago, now he's been one of the great Gedolim, signed a beautiful letter of support. Beautiful. How it's important, how it saves difficult situations. His only quibble was, he thinks that Nachla Shiva Simen Tes was that she shouldn't starve. Not as an incentive to actually give a get in a timely fashion, but it doesn't matter. It's an irrelevancy. This indicates to Nachla Shiva that we can overcome the problem of Asmachta by copying them. Now, there is one Gadol who wrote, no. In Nachla Shiva days, they had the power of Hefker Bezet Hefker, because it was there. We don't have that power anymore. But it's not so, I don't believe, because if you look carefully in the... By the way, this is not found somewhere in the missing world. It's on the page of the Shulchan Aruch. On the page of the Shulchan Aruch has a citation, Machmas Idu Ktat Ketakana Shum, and the Pischei Tshuva, they write that in Ashkenaz, you have to write it. In Poland, it's an automatic. Oh, so if in Poland it's automatic, you can argue it's Hefker, Bezin, Hefker. But in Ashkenaz, you have to write it, it's obviously not. So therefore, it should work in Chicago, the same as it worked in Ashkenaz, if you ask me. Now, my time is up, and I don't want to take away the time from Rav Schwartz Shalita. It was a very brief summary of some of the considerations regarding this prenup. I strongly, strongly recommend that if you're getting married, or your children are getting married, or your grandchildren are getting married, please have them sign. I'm sure they're in Chicago. The Bezdin can take care of it. Deposit the original in the Bezdin. The two sides can keep copies for themselves. And this way, it's like, as I said, an insurance policy. In the schus of doing this out of love for your spouse, at a time of love, you should be blessed with a marriage full of love, which will last forever. Amen v'yamin.